Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder. Today's episode is inspired by our film, a documentary on the role of John Adams in administering justice and one of the most controversial trials before the American founding, the Boston Massacre Trial of 1770. Our guest today is Dr. Sarah Martin, editor-in-chief of the Adams Papers at the Massachusetts Historical Society. Sarah manages the Adams Papers editorial project at the Massachusetts Historical Society. Since its establishment in 1954, the Adams Papers has published letterpress volumes of the diaries, letters, and other writings of the Adams family of Massachusetts. They published two letterpress series, The Adams Family Correspondence and The Papers of John Adams, and two digital editions, The Adams Papers Digital Edition and The John Quincy Adams Digital Diary. Sarah has joined us today to talk about her work on the Adams Papers and what she can tell us about other famous Adams family members. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Samantha. It's a pleasure to be here and to share what I do and more information about the Adamses.
So how did you end up editing the Adams Papers, and how many papers are there to edit?
So we have hundreds of thousands of papers, and many of those are at the Massachusetts Historical Society in our core collection, which is the Adams Family Papers. And then we also consider for publication papers within other collections at the Massachusetts Historical Society, but also held throughout the world. And what we do at the editorial project is publish a comprehensive edition of the collected writings for three generations of the family. And so that runs from Abigail and John Adams through their grandchildren. And it's a span of about 150 years. And so kind of the information contained within that scope of papers is really remarkable in terms of how it can illuminate American history. The Adamses were present at key moments and were witnesses to many others. And so their collective memory really includes the events leading to the American Revolution and the fallout from the Civil War. And within that, they're writing about the big events, what we know now as major historical events, but their everyday lives, the social and cultural fabric that make up American life, is woven throughout their correspondence as well. So it really is a treasure trove for researchers and scholars, but also for anyone who is interested in learning more about American life. And I think what is really remarkable about the family's papers is that as they got preserved through the generations, it wasn't just the men's writing or the men's writing as public figures, but it's really the family's collected correspondence. And so we have a huge trove of writings by the female members of the family. And with hundreds of thousands of pages to work with, it means that as editors, we have stayed busy for more than a generation and will continue to do so probably long past my career. And I came to the Adams Papers editorial project at the Massachusetts Historical Society in 2008. And I began as an assistant editor and came as a trained public historian and historical editor. And I'd worked previously with diaries and had done this type of work. And over nearly 15 years, I've really immersed myself in the lives of the Adamses and have come to direct the project and really just find it such a joy and a wonder to work with this remarkable historical artifact and to really share and make American history more accessible through their writings.
Who's the most prolific writer of Adams Papers, and do you have any highlights or any interesting facts that you've gleaned from all these years working with Adams Papers?
So I think John Quincy Adams probably claims the role as the most prolific writer. He both was a comprehensive diarist, and so he kept a diary for 68 years and wrote in it nearly daily, and his total diary spans about 15,000 manuscript pages, which the project is currently working to make accessible online through transcription and images of the manuscript pages. And then he was a copious letter writer. And so I think he was probably the most prolific. But there are so many gems within the collected writings, and again, thousands of pages and thousands of documents. And it depends what you're interested in. But I think you can find that Adams is commenting on pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. And it's really rewarding to kind of immerse yourself in their letters. You know, we have nearly 1,200 extant letters just between John and Abigail. And they demonstrate a range of emotions. You know, you can laugh and you can cry, and you can see their anger and their joy. And then the topics that they write about can run the gamut from really insightful political commentary about the world around them to gossipy letters about what's mm-hmm. going on next door. And you know, farm reports. You know, Abigail Adams can write about what she's reading on agriculture and then how she's implementing what she's learned through reading in her management of the family's farms.
I've heard over the years that the letters between John and Abigail Adams were quite something. What was their relationship like?
They really are. I mean, the letters are, they're just remarkable. And I think their relationship was really founded in love and mutual respect and trust. And I think that it is evident when you read their letters. And like I said, there are nearly 1,200 extant letters between the two of them that are written between 1764 and 1801. So it's a good chunk of their lives, although both of them went on to live long after 1801. And I think when you take a step back from that fact and question why we have 1,200 extant letters, it becomes even more remarkable because it is when they are apart that they are writing. And over that span of nearly four decades that they maintained a correspondence, they do so because they are apart. And they're apart because of John Adams's career, right? First as a lawyer who's writing the circuit. So he's traveling throughout Massachusetts, arguing before county courts and throughout the state. And then he is participating in the events that lead to the revolution and the events that lead to the establishment of the government and the first few decades of the United States of America. And sometimes Abigail is with him on those journeys, and sometimes she stays at home. And so when he's in Europe as a diplomat, he serves in the Netherlands, in France, and England. And then he is serving at the various cities that serve as the federal seat in the U.S. Capitol, whether it's New York or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. And so they spend a lot of time apart. And the way that they maintain the threads of their relationship is through their correspondence.
So did John Adams' letters read like those of a lawyer? Did his lawyerly career come through in his writing?
At times it does. And I think one of the things that you definitely notice when you read his letters is his great respect for the law and his belief in the rule of law. And whether that is him as a lawyer or him reflecting on the public events in which he's participating, you know, in the 1790s and the early 19th century, he's commenting about judicial independence and a lot of his beliefs about government and governance come from his grounding in law.
Interesting. So you mentioned that Abigail Adams, her political views came through in the letters. What were some of Abigail Adams's political views?
So Abigail shared many of John's political views. She could at times be more conservative. But in general, they shared a similar political mind. She mm-hmm. believed, as her husband did, that public education was critical to the American citizenry. So to the establishment of the American Republic, education was really important. And that women had a pivotal role in that education, both mm-hmm. in the fact that they were the first educators of their children, so the sons that would grow to run the government, women, mothers were the first instructors. But even more so than John, she believed that women should also be educated. And Abigail did not receive a formal education. She was taught to read at home through mm-hmm. her father and her grandmother. And she had access to wonderful mentors and vast amounts of reading material. But she never went to school. And she felt that lack of formal schooling really keenly at certain points in her life. And so she was a very strong advocate for female education. You know, she writes in 1776, "If we mean to have heroes and statesmen and philosophers, we should also have learned women." And you see this theme about public education and education of girls and women resurface continually throughout her correspondence during the course of her life.
Was her level of education common among women of her era? Was she undereducated, maybe even overeducated? What was the status of her education compared to her contemporaries?
Well, you don't think you can ever really be overeducated. And I think she would she would say that that's true too. I think her level of education was more common than not among women within her social strata, right? Mm-hmm. And so she had more time to learn than maybe someone who had fewer means. Same is true today, right? Access mm-hmm. is often contingent on wealth. And so she had access. She also had access because of how and where she grew up, right? So her father is a congregational minister. And so their home was kind of the local center for discussion and community. Mm-hmm. And she had access to her father's library. And then she meets John Adams and his friend Richard Cranch, who ends up marrying her sister. And both Richard Cranch and John Adams were very well educated and very well read, and also encouraged Abigail and her sister Mary Smith Cranch to read and to engage in kind of intellectual discourse, right? And so she has a circle of women with whom she corresponds, and you can see an exchange of ideas and the kinds of things that they're reading. But she also loved to learn. Going back to that idea that, you know, she's writing to John about reading agricultural texts because she wants to better manage the farm, you know, and so she's reading scientific texts and she's reading some classical texts and she's reading novels and loves Shakespeare and Pope and Addison. And so you can read her correspondence and see a lot of literary references mm-hmm. and a reflection of her learning and her kind of constant, her kind of continual pursuit of knowledge.
To quote Abigail Adams and to make a plug for another FedSoc film, Remember the Ladies, can you tell us about this line that she wrote in a letter and what was her Remember the Ladies letter?
Sure. So Abigail wrote that letter to John Adams in March 1776. And she writes it at the end of March 1776, about 2 weeks after the British evacuate Boston. And so for much of the previous year, the locus of the American Revolution, the fighting, was in Massachusetts and Boston specifically. Mm-hmm. And so she has kind of the immediacy of war while John is in Philadelphia serving in the Continental Congress. And with the evacuation of Boston in the middle of March 1776, she's sort of that the relief that she feels, it's palpable in other parts of the letter. You know, she writes about how she wasn't sure they were going to be able to plant this spring, and now she feels like they can. And she also is able to turn to kind of the ideology of the revolution and really graft onto the revolutionary rhetoric in order to make a case for greater consideration of women under the new government that the men at the Continental Congress are considering. And what she means by that is kind of she is pointing to the fact that married women especially, women in general, but married women especially, had very little legal identity under British law. And that has transplanted to the colonies. And so as a married woman, they weren't allowed to own property in their own name, except under very particular circumstances. And so she's arguing for a greater recognition of women and women's rights in order to kind of combat, you know, what we kind of look at now as this patriarchal worldview. And so that's kind of what she's pointing to. And she does it in a way that really grafts the revolutionary rhetoric, right? So she says, remember, I urge you to remember the ladies. And as she continues on, she says, you know, we will really not be a party to a code of laws that we don't have a voice in. And you can hear that kind of off-repeated phrase of no taxation without representation. Mm-hmm. And she's really making a plug for that using kind of similar language. And it is language that would have been immediately recognizable to her husband as kind of resounding and kind of echoing the rhetoric that he's hearing in Philadelphia.
Did John Adams support or agree with Abigail's plea for an expansion of married women's rights?
No. He sort of dismisses her. You know, he's like, oh, you're saucy. That's what he calls her saucy. And he says, of course we wouldn't do that, you know. And then he kind of teases her and says, oh, but you know, women really do hold the power. And he means kind of the power in the home. And she is not happy with that response. She complains about it to her friend Mercy Otis Warren. And she writes to him again and says, I don't think that you've been really very kind to me about this. And that letter, so the Remember the Ladies letter, really sparks this longer correspondence on this topic, both between John and Abigail. But you can also see it in their correspondence to other people.
I didn't know that second part. That's so interesting. So you have access to all of the writings of John Adams. What would you say is the most striking thing about John Adams's writings? Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I think how thoughtful he can be at times, and then also how emotional he can be at times. And I think it's one of the really wonderful things about the kind of work that historical editors do. We immerse ourselves so much in the life and writings of the people we publish. And frequently you come to the topic with a lot of knowledge, right? Many of us have studied these people. We have graduate degrees. We've spent a lot of time gaining that knowledge. Mm-hmm. And yet the intimacy you get when you sort of live with their correspondence day in and day out, and the nuance that comes out about their personalities and their characters, it's really astounding. And I think what's really wonderful and what emerges from reading John Adams's correspondence is how multifaceted he is and how much different he can come off at times to some of the stereotypical kind of portrayals of him as kind of a, you know, portly, stodgy, kind of curmudgeonly individual.
That's a great answer. So last March was the 250th anniversary of the Boston Massacre. Why should we care about this famous or infamous trial? And what did you glean from this trial in reading the Adams papers, if anything?
So I think the Boston Massacre in trials is an important moment on the road to the American Revolution, right? So it's taking place in 1770. So, you know, we're after the Stamp Act and we're before Lexington and Concord, kind of smack in the middle of that. And it is representative of the increasing tensions between colonists and Crown. Mm-hmm. And it kind of exemplifies John Adams's commitment to the rule of law.
Hmm.
And John Adams, who was a patriot, represents the British soldiers. And he does so, he writes later in his autobiography, he says, you know, counsel ought to be the very last thing that an accused person should want in a free country. Hmm. And so, and he stuck to that idea his entire life. Like in all of his recollections about the Boston Massacre and trials, he took great pride over the fact that this was not mob rule that governed, but that on the way to establishing American society, the rule of law prevailed, because to him, that was emblematic of a civilized society.
Right. And it's almost like the instantiation of the reminder of the Magna Carta and the importance of the rule of law, right? Like the crown, no, you know, entity is above or below the law. The law applies equally to everyone. And so even your, you know, oppressors, or even the, you know, people you don't like or are trying to revolt from, they deserve a fair shake, so to speak.
Exactly.
So what did John Adams or anyone in the Adams papers write about the trial? Do you have any insight into how John Adams was viewed as a lawyer at the time of the trial?
Sure. So taking your first question, he left trial notes. So he took minutes during the trials, and these were long trials, unusually long for the time period, where trials frequently lasted a day. The two main trials in the Boston Massacre trials each lasted 5 days. So very unusual. And mm-hmm. So he took pretty detailed minutes, and we have those minutes. And that is a large portion of what we have at the time written by Adams. Mm-hmm. And the Adams Papers editorial project has published those along with kind of the extant evidence and documentation relating to the trials. They actually comprise an entire volume of the legal papers of John Adams, which anyone who really wants to get into the weeds and go into the nitty-gritty of this historical detail can read for free online via the Massachusetts Historical Society website by finding the Adams Papers digital edition and looking at volume 3 of the John Adams legal papers. Other than those trial notes and the existing documentation written by some of his contemporaries and colleagues, we don't have a lot of contemporary accounts about either the massacre or the trials. And partly John Adams, who kept a diary sporadically throughout his life, did not keep a diary during this period. And he and Abigail are together during this period. Mm-hmm. And so they are not writing to each other. Abigail is not writing during this period. We actually have no extant correspondence from Abigail from the beginning of 1770 until into early 1771. And that's in part because she is really busy as a mother of a young family. She has three children, and one of whom dies, and she gives birth to another all around, you know, the first half of 1770. And so they were busy. And so we don't have a lot of kind of contemporary accounts. Mm-hmm. What we do know of John Adams's views come through in later correspondence and then his autobiography. And so, you know, we have the anniversary of the Boston Massacre being marked very early on. And we have some correspondence in 1772 where John Adams has been asked to speak on the anniversary and he actually declines. And we have him commenting, you know, the occasion is still noted in the 1780s and 1790s. So we have a great letter that he wrote in 1787 where he says, you know, in writing about the trials, he says, I had good policy as well as sound law on my side when I ventured to lay open before our people the laws against riots, routs, and unlawful assemblies. Mobs will never do to govern states or command armies. I was sensible of it in 70, as I am in 87, to talk of liberty in such a state of things. And that's, you know, we see that same sentiment echoed in his autobiography, which was written a little more than 30 years after the events of 1770. And so you have to kind of look at them through the prism of time and consider all that happened in the intervening period between 1770 and the first decade of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But he does kind of maintain his pride in participating in the events, mm-hmm. and stands by, despite the fact that he kind of caught some flack for doing it, he stands by his participation and the fact that he represented the defense in that case. And speaking to your second question about how he was viewed at the time, you know, he was a well-respected lawyer. He had been admitted to the bar in the late 1750s, so he'd been practicing law for more than a decade by the time the massacre trials rolled around. He had just been named earlier in 1770 the clerk for the Suffolk County Bar. He had a 15-year law career overall. He was, you know, this is the man who in 1780 is chosen by his community to represent them at the State Constitutional Convention and is responsible for drafting the Constitution that, although heavily amended, still governs the Commonwealth today. And so he was a really strong legal mind, and he was well-respected. Even though his role in defending the soldiers did cause some tension and did kind of gain him some kind of backlash and flack over the years.
So interesting. So based on your reading of the letters, did Abigail Adams have any impact on her husband's legal career at all overall or during the trial or in particular?
So I think so we know that he occasionally writes to Abigail about his cases. So when he's out on the circuit in the 1760s and the 1770s, we have kind of a handful of letters where he mentioned his cases. And so we can gain some insight into John Adams's legal career through his correspondence with Abigail. We know a little bit about how his legal career impacted their family life because we have some letters that Abigail writes to especially her sister, Mary Smith Cranch, talking about how kind of the structure of the court sessions impacts their family and their ability to travel or to do certain things because they need to be, you know, they need to stay put for John Adams's career. And so we get a little bit of insight in there. But in 1770, she is really consumed with the immediate needs of her family. Mm-hmm. And we have very little correspondence. In fact, after I think it's about January 1770, we don't have any extant letters from Abigail during this period. And partly that's because she and John were together, right? He's in Boston when these events are happening and he's arguing in court in Boston. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that he's written to her a little bit suggests that they were talking about his cases. And so certainly as Abigail served as advisor and sounding board and at times devil's advocate in other aspects of his career, we can kind of assume that that happened here too. But it's really opaque in answering that question. We have to extrapolate a lot mm-hmm. because we don't have direct evidence. And certainly while Abigail was well-read, she wasn't trained as a legal scholar, where John had a community of lawyers around him. And so he certainly had other resources to talk through ideas.
So pivoting to another Adams family member, who was Sam Adams other than the namesake of a beer? And what was his relationship to the famous Boston Massacre trial, if there was one?
So Sam Adams, Samuel Adams, is John Adams's second cousin. And Samuel Adams was a patriot. He was a leader of the Sons of Liberty. He was active in the patriotic cause from the start. And so in 1770, when you have tension between the colonists and the representatives of the crown, who at this time are troops, right? So the British troops had occupied Boston since 1768. And there had been ebbs and flows of interaction between colonists and crown. There'd been tension. That tension had occasionally erupted into violence. And Sam Adams was continually one of the leaders of the patriotic cause. And so after the events of March 5th, 1770, he is one of the people that is keeping the events present in the popular kind of mind. And that's because the governor, Thomas Hutchinson, wants public sentiment to quiet down. And so he pushes for delays in the trials because he wants kind of that the tensions to settle a bit. And in fact, there's several months between the events of March 5th and the trials, which don't start until late October 1770 and wrap up in December 1770. And so Adams is one of the agitators that's keeping kind of the anti-British sentiment going. Now, he and John Adams at this period have a good relationship. John Adams is a patriot. And so he is recruited and he, you know, converses with Samuel Adams. So they're interacting and there's correspondence between the two of them. And so I'd say they had a pretty good relationship, and we don't have any direct correspondence between the two of them on the subject of the events of March 5th, 1770 or the trials, but certainly they interacted around those events.
So in your years of research in the Adams letters, aside from John, Abigail, and Sam, are there any other notable Adamses who wrote anything saucy, spicy, interesting, or otherwise worthy of note?
Oh, yes. And so many, and too many to discuss. But I think that's a wonderful thing about working on a multi-generational project, is you can intersect with the family at different points in time and about different topics. And so depending what your topic is, you can get to it in different ways. And I think although not directly in Adams, she's considered family, The letters Mary Smith Cranch writes are really wonderful, and the exchange between her and Abigail Adams are wonderful, because just as Abigail is John's closest advisor and trusted kind of confidant, Mary Smith Cranch is Abigail's. And so you get a lot of insight into Abigail through her sister. Mm-hmm. And I think in addition to that, Louisa Catherine Johnson Adams, who is John Quincy's wife, she was also very different than Abigail, but also very politically savvy, right? And is really through Louisa's efforts that John Quincy Adams rises as high as he does politically. You know, she is the one that is navigating Washington etiquette and the social scene and hosting the parties that put the politicians in the room together so they can advocate, and is really working to advance John Quincy's career. And so she's another one that frequently comes off as one-dimensional because she was ill a lot in her life. But when you get into it, she is smart and she is very politically savvy.
So going back to Abigail Adams and her influence on her husband, was there any correspondence on, that is evocative of Abigail Adams' role as First Lady and you know, her contributions or what was expected of her? Did she write a lot during that time, or no, because they were both together?
So she did write a lot during that time. And I would say actually that's one of the most prolific periods of correspondence we have from Abigail, both because at times she and John are separated and so they're writing to each other, but also because she's maintaining ties with family and community when she's serving at the Capitol with her Massachusetts correspondence, right? And so we have correspondence with her children, and we have correspondence with her sisters, and correspondence with friends. And so it is really rich, and it offers great insight into her public role during John Adams's vice presidency and presidency. And I think some of the best early correspondence about her kind of years as First Lady really comes even before John Adams's inauguration. We have a wonderful exchange between Abigail Adams and Martha Washington where the results of the election have been announced. So it dates to kind of February 1797. And Abigail writes to Martha Washington, you know, saying, "Hey, congratulations on your retirement. And by the way, do you have any advice for me as I take over this role that you've had?" And there's a wonderful reply from Martha Washington where Martha Washington, you know, pays compliments and says, "You'll be fine. And since you asked, here's how I did it." And really lays out the social rules that governed her responsibilities as First Lady, and in many ways were modeled by the Adamses. So Abigail held a weekly drawing room when she was with John at the seat of government. The Adamses hosted dinners. And, you know, on the 4th of July, they had something like I would call it an open house, you know, where people could come visit and they supplied cake and refreshments. There's a wonderful letter she writes, one of her sisters, where, you know, she's writing after the event and describing it and saying, "Oh, it's so hot. We barely got through the day. There were so many people," and, you know, made something like 200 slices of cake available or something like that. And there was one left at the end of the day. And so you can kind of gain insight into her social role. And then when you take the fuller kind of range of her correspondence during the years of John Adams's presidency, you can really see her influence on John, and also the ways that she attempted to influence the community around her. So we have a lot of letters where Abigail is writing to people in different cities, sending them information and asking them to have it inserted in the local newspapers. We have a few instances mm-hmm. where Abigail Adams is directly engaging editors of newspapers to either set the record straight. So sometimes she defends John, sometimes she defends John Quincy Adams, or she's recommending that they print something, which is frequently a letter from John Quincy Adams, who is serving in Europe while his father is president. And you can see her influence in that way, the ways that she understood her public role and the ways that she could advance her husband's kind of the goals of her husband's administration, and the fact that she was really his trusted advisor, especially as his presidency became more embattled and he started having, you know, greater divisions within his cabinet and within the Federalist Party.
So based on the letters between Abigail and John, would you say that the Adams marriage is any different or is of note compared to other marriages at the time? Did they have a more close relationship or maybe a different relationship than most other marriages at the time? What can you say about their – what you've learned about their relationship based on their letters?
So I think reading their letters, it's really evident that they had a marriage based on love and mutual respect and trust. And what is unusual is that because we have so much extant correspondence, we are able to see that relationship, right? So I don't know that their relationship was unusual. I think marriage in the 18th century was much like marriage today, and that they're all different kinds of marriages, right? And some are based on love and some are based on more kind of transactional, you know, they are more of kind of a transactional relationship for financial purposes. Certainly women have more rights today within a marriage than they did in the 18th century. So I think it's less that their marriage is either representative or divergent of a common marriage. I think what is unusual is that because we have nearly 1,200 extant letters between the two of them, we can really see more about the evolution of their relationship, right? So we have courtship letters mm-hmm. that date to 1764, the year before they got married, 1762, before they got married. And running really through the first year of the 19th century. And so when you have that long of a correspondence, you can really see how two people grow and how a relationship evolves. And so I think that's what's unusual, is having kind of that level of intimate detail, which of course wasn't known at the time, but some of their letters have been published since the mid-19th century. And so information about them as individuals and as a married couple has really been available for a very long time. Not necessarily as fully as we publish it today in the modern documentary edition, but certainly it's been available and it's been read. And so I think that's the unusual aspect of it, not so much that it is kind of an outlier in terms of what a typical marriage was.
Interesting. So what can law school students learn from John Adams or any of the Adams papers? What could be of interest to law school students or lawyers in reading the papers of John Adams or any other members of his family?
So I think either John Adams's letters, or especially really any of his sons who were all trained as lawyers, but most specifically through John Quincy's letters, you can really gain a sense of what it meant to be a lawyer and their legal thinking at the time, right? So much of their legal thought was grounded in a classical education. And in so many of their writings, especially in John Adams's writings, it's referential to kind of classical Greek and classical Rome and society. And their thoughts on government are rooted in those classical ideals, and they're very referential. You can also see kind of the evolution of English law and how American law develops out of the English tradition, right? And so, you know, the references to what they should study and what they did study and the roots in common law are all very evident throughout the Adams's correspondence. So for someone who is interested in the evolution of legal theory, the Adams's letters provide really good insight into kind of what that looked like in the mid-18th century and then what that looked like at the end of the 18th century. And how it was practiced by the Adamses as lawyers.
So interesting. Do you have any other comments, insight, anything else you'd like to share about your experience with these vast Adams family papers?
I would just encourage anyone who is really interested in American history from really the 1750s through the turn of the 20th century to come have a look and spend a little time with the Adamses. There is so much fascinating material, and the Massachusetts Historical Society and the Adams Papers Editorial Project is working to make more of it accessible electronically. And there's a little bit for everything, or excuse me, there's a little bit for everybody. And I just welcome you into the work that we do, because the work that we do is make these writings accessible to the public for them to read and enjoy and use in their own work. And so I just welcome you to visit us at www.masshist.org/Adams and learn a little bit more about the Adams papers.
Great. I'm definitely going to check it out. I'm very curious about to read the full Remember the Lady's letter, and also John's response in calling her saucy. Very intrigued by that.
It is a wonderful exchange, and it's available online. And I'm happy to provide links to some of the things I mentioned specifically today. And if you want to make those available, that's fine too.
Great. So thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us today for another episode of the FedSoc Films podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been an enjoyable conversation, and I hope we have engaged your audience, maybe drawn a few more people into the world of the Adamses.
Absolutely. Our guest today is Dr. Sarah Martin, Editor-in-Chief of the Adams Papers at the Massachusetts Historical Society. You can check out the film, An Attorney for All Men, John Adams and the Boston Massacre Trial, on YouTube, Facebook, or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a review. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.